Bhagavatam verses and commentaries by our acharyas. And we started, well, recently completed chapter 8, which ends with Mother Jasoda looking inside Krishna's mouth and seeing what she saw and getting confused and overwhelmed. Krishna then again covering her with yogamaya potency, so she forgot what she saw and just thought, as a intense love of a mother for Krishna, vatsalya rasa, parental affection. And at the end of that lila, Shukadeva Goswami says, she's beyond whatever the reach of the Vedas, different parts of the Vedas teach different aspects of God or the Lord. And this Veda section teaches this, and that Veda section teaches that. But Mother Jasoda is beyond all that. She is in this most exalted position of Braja Prem. She only sees Krishna as her beloved child. And then there's this discussion. Maharaj Parikshit, who's hearing from Shukadeva Goswami, says, wow. What austerities did she perform and Nanda Maharaj perform to come to this stage? And again says that their love exceeds the love of Vasudeva and Devaki. Because although Vasudeva and Devaki were awarded the service of being the so-called mother-father, because you can't be mother-father of the Supreme Lord, but they had that service. And so then, but they didn't have the experience of Krishna's childhood pastimes. But Yasoda and Nanda were intimately associated with those pastimes. So they were even more fortunate, most fortunate. Mahabhaga. And then there's some discussion that concludes the chapter. The great fortune of Yasoda and Nanda, which opens the door for chapter 9, which is the Damodar Lila, where the first 20 verses are just Mother Jasoda's love for Krishna is super excellent, unequaled anywhere. And there's descriptions saying that Nanda and Jasoda, they're with Krishna in Krishna Loka. They eternally, they didn't become. One cannot become. It's not a post. They're eternal associates. And their love is so intense and so pure that when Krishna performed his worldly pastime, Prakat Lila, from place, and Nanda and Jasoda appear, and they enrich and strengthen and expand the natural love of all the other associates because their love is so intense. So the Damodar Lila ends, it's two chapters. It ends with Krishna liberating Nalakuvera and Manigriva from the two trees, the Yamala Arjuna trees. And now we're reading chapter 11. I want to, during Kartik month, I want to just cover 9 and 10. It's very, very, very detailed and wonderful pastime. So chapter 11 opens with Nanda hears a big crash. And he comes running. And much to his surprise, he sees what he sees. He sees little Krishna, a toddler. He says, between 2 and 3 years old, little boy, with the rope tied around his waist, at the other end of the rope tied around a wooden grinding mortar, and he's looking in amazement at the whole scene. And the ladies, they come running because they heard the crash, and they see Krishna, and they have different emotions, transcendental emotions, because Krishna is the object. For some are astonished, some are fearful, some are puzzled, some are this and some are that, but they're all then, how did this happen? And the little boys, they were with Krishna, because when Mother Jasoda bound Krishna, it wasn't just, there were, his friends were with him. Little boys, 2 to 3 years old boys, saying, we saw, he did it. They point to Krishna. He's, you know, with his little rope tied around his waist. And they described everything exactly as it happened. He began to toddle, and he pulled over the grinding mortar, and it went sideways, got stuck between the two trees. And here, I learned this from visiting Vrindavan, that Arjuna trees are very specific. Yamala Arjuna trees are hardwood trees. Like oak here in the West is hardwood. And there's different qualities of wood, but oak is really... So Yamala Arjuna tree is really hardwood with a very deep root system. So it's not just he pulled over a tree, but he pulled over one of those kind. So the roots are sticking up in the air. They said there was no hurricane and no big wind and no thunderbolts and no elephants. And how did this happen? And the boys said, he did it. And they could see, the commentary says, that they could see where the grinding mortar was dragged across the ground because it was heavy. And they could see so the boys said he pulled the trees over. And not only that, but two celestial beings came out of the trees and spoke some words to Krishna. So the elders, it's child's talk. They couldn't take it seriously. And then there's some description that some of the brahmanas, because they were also skeptical, but on the other hand, because they're brahmanas, they could consider the situation carefully. It was said by Garga Muni that Krishna would have powers like Narayana. He didn't say he was Narayana. He didn't say he wasn't Narayana. He said he'd have powers like Narayana. And so maybe he did pull the trees over. And then we ended up yesterday where the commentary says, normally when Krishna shows his Aishvarya, his opulences, it has a tendency to diminish the sweetness, and they see his divinity. But for these brahmanas, by the influence of Nanda and Yashoda, their affection for Krishna was so strong that it served to increase their affection for Krishna rather than have them doubt maybe he's not just Nanda's son, maybe he's God. And they made the comparison to the torrents of rain coming down by Indra's arrangement on the Kandava forest. It didn't put out the forest fire. It served to increase the flames like ghee poured on fire. So we ended having this whole description of the Kandava forest. Maybe you'd like to hear that description. It's from Mahabharata. And there was a... How old is the boy that was there last night? 12? 13? 13-year-old boy knew the whole story from the comic books. Chitra comic books. So here's this is where we ended up yesterday, but it's a nice description. And I think the children will like Especially the boys, because there's a battle scene.
Yeah, that's what they
mean. I learned that there's a battle scene. You want to hear a battle scene? No. Come on. You want some ice cream? No. Okay, here we go. Get my reading glasses. Really well written, and I'm sure you'll recognize the story. That the scene opens in Hastinapur. Actually, it's not Hastinapur yet. It's Indraprastha, and it's after Arjuna, because Arjuna had gone on pilgrimage. Arjuna went on pilgrimage because there was a scene where some robbers were harassing the cowherd men. And the cowherd men came and took shelter of Arjuna. Help! They're taking our cows. So Arjuna immediately went and got his weapons and dismissed them all. And when he came back, he said to Yudhisthira, we had this vow that for 1 month, each of the brothers would be with Draupadi, and it was your time to be with Draupadi, and I came to get my weapons where you were with Draupadi, and so I made an offense and I should go in pilgrimage because I've broken a vow that was told by your mother. And Yudhisthira said, no. What you did was emergency. Emergency supersedes regulation. So you didn't do any violation. And he said, no, I'm going to go on pilgrimage. I've decided. So he's on pilgrimage, and he went to holy places. Many things happened. One of those things happened was his marriage to Subhadra in Dwarka. And it's a long story. But after that marriage with Arjuna and Subhadra, then the Yadu dynasty elders, including Balaram and others, accompanied Arjuna and Subhadra to Indraprastha. And they're in Indraprastha, and there's a big festival, and there's gift giving, and it's a very nice time. And that's where we're going to pick up. With Balaram at their head, the Yadus headed back to Dwarka. But Krishna decided to remain behind to spend some time alone with Arjuna. One day, Arjuna suggested, oh, Krishna, the days are hot. Let us go for some time to the banks of the Yamuna. We have constructed many fine pleasure houses there. Krishna agreed to his proposal, and they set off. They soon arrived at a charming spot amid groves of tall trees. High white mansions stood along the river banks, looking like a city of the gods. Krishna and Arjuna entered one of the houses where they were served varieties of exquisitely flavored foods and drinks. They lay down upon golden couches spread with silk covers. After relaxing for some time, they decided to go for a walk in the woods. The two heroes wandered along the riverbank discussing martial arts. Martial arts. And past battles that had each fought. Having walked for a distance, they sat down upon an ivory bench that had been placed near the edge of a dense forest. As they continued to talk, a Brahmin suddenly emerged from the woods. They looked at him in surprise. He resembled an old sal tree with a complexion like molten gold. His beard and hair were bright yellow, and he shone like the morning sun. His two eyes were like lotus leaves, and his body was well-formed and powerful. As the Brahman approached them, blazing like fire, Krishna and Arjuna stood up and awaited his order. In a resonant voice, the Brahman said, resonant voice, I know you two to be the foremost of all men. I myself am a voracious Brahman who eats much. I have therefore approached you in order to beg my food and to be gratified by you. Both Krishna and Arjuna folded their palms and asked the Brahman what food he would like. The Brahman replied, I do not eat ordinary food. Know me to be Agni, the fire god. Give me food that suits me. Please help me devour this Khandava forest. He indicated the jungle by gesture by which they were standing. Although he had already made many attempts to consume the forest, his efforts had been repeatedly thwarted by Indra. This was because Indra's friend, the Naga Takshaka, lived in the forest. Whenever Agni blazed up and began to cover the forest, Indra would send torrents of rain to stop him. The fire god continued, Both of you are experts in arms. By your prowess, you will be able to prevent Indra from stopping me. Thus I shall consume this great forest, O heroes. This is the food I desire to have from you. Krishna and Arjuna looked at each other in surprise. They assured Agni that they would do everything in their power to help him, but they were curious as to why he wanted to consume this particular forest. The deity explained that the Khandava forest contained numerous varieties of medicinal herbs. He needed the herbs because he was suffering a malady due to having eaten excessive amounts of ghee. There had been a great sacrifice performed by a king named Shwetaki, in which so much ghee was offered into the fire that Agni became ill. Brahma then told him that he could be cured if he ate the herbs in the Khandava forest. When Agni failed in his attempts to consume the forest, Brahma told him that he would succeed if he could gain the assistance of Krishna and Arjuna. Brahma had said, In a previous incarnation, these two men were in fact the ancient and infallible deities Nara and Narayana. They have appeared on the earth to accomplish the celestial's purpose, therefore ask for their help. Agni concluded, I now depend on you too. I must eat this forest. Brahma has also informed me that the living beings within the forest are sinful and should be destroyed. Therefore, do not harbor any doubts. This act is sanctioned by authority. Of course, Krishna is the supreme authority, but Brahma's authority too. Arjuna replied, I possess many celestial weapons, but I have no bow capable of bearing their power. If I am to achieve the task you have set, I will require an inexhaustible quiver of arrows and a chariot drawn by celestial steeds. If you can provide all this, then we will surely accomplish your desire. Agni meditated upon Varuna, god of the netherworlds, and the deity immediately appeared and said, What shall I do for you? Agni knew that Varuna kept many celestial weapons in the depths of the ocean. Therefore, he asked him to present Arjuna with the celestial bow Gandiva, as well as two inexhaustible quivers of arrows. Agni also asked that Varuna bring forth a chariot belonging to Soma, the moon god. Varuna agreed and caused all those things to appear at that very spot. Arjuna looked with wonder at the Gandiva bow. It appeared like a rainbow embedded with celestial gems. As tall as a man, it was flawless. The Pandava took up the shining bow and forcefully twanged its string. A sound like the crash of thunder resounded throughout the forest, terrifying all the creatures. Holding the bow, the joyful Arjuna next approached the huge golden chariot. It was filled with varieties of celestial weapons, as well as the two inexhaustible quivers Agni had requested. The chariot was yoked with golden harnesses to silvery steeds from the land of the Gandharvas. These horses were capable of going anywhere within the world, all the worlds, and could move with the speed of the wind or the mind. Above the chariot flew a banner bearing the image of who was on the flag of Arjuna chariot? Hanuman. Yeah. Rama's great monkey servant Hanuman seemed to be burning everything that fell within his gaze. Other flags on the chariot bearing images of fierce beasts. All the creatures roared terribly from their standards, getting ready for battle. The kids are going away. That's too bad. Arjuna circumambulated the chariot and then mounted it like a victorious man ascending to heaven. He put on the suit of celestial armor that lay there. He stood with the Gandiva bow in his hand, resembling the sun shining from behind an evening cloud. Then he drove the chariot around smiling as he heard the loud rumble of its wheels. Varuna also gave Krishna a club called, what's the name of Krishna's club? Starts with a K. Kaumudaki, which roared loudly when wheeled about and which could crush even Daityas and Danavas. Krishna then mounted Arjuna's chariot, saying that he would become the driver. Arjuna again addressed Agni, "O fire god, we are now ready to satisfy your request. Armed with the Gandiva and assisted by Krishna, I am able to withstand the entire host of gods united with the Asuras." What to speak of Indra? "Therefore, blaze up as much as you like and surround this forest." Agni immediately expanded himself around the forest and began to consume it with his seven kinds of flames. He assumed the fearful appearance he assumes at the end of an eon, which he uses to destroy all things. Krishna then began to drive the chariot around the forest. It moved with such speed that it appeared to be continuously present at every side of the forest. Whenever Arjuna saw a creature trying to escape from the conflagration, he immediately shot it down. Being slain in the presence of Krishna, the supreme deity, all the creatures dying in that forest assumed their spiritual forms and ascended to the highest regions of transcendence. The roar of the fire could be heard for miles. Red, orange, and blue flames shot high into the sky. The lakes and ponds in the forest were boiled dry, and the rocks melted. No creature was able to escape from the blazing Kandava forest, and their screams mixed with the crackling of the fire. It blazed up to such an extent that it caused fear even to the celestials, who went in a body to Indra and said anxiously, "Oh, Lord of the immortals, why does Agni burn all creatures below? Has the time come from the world's destruction?" Indra looked himself to see what was happening on the earth. Feeling concern for his friend Takshaka, he set out at once to stop the fire. He sent down torrents of rain, which fell in columns as thick as tree trunks. But the rain was turned to steam by the heat of the fire, even before it reached the forest below. Indra then became angry and amassed huge clouds over the forest, which doubled the volume of rain. With its flames and smoke rising up, and with lightning and sheets of water falling from the sky, the forest became terrifying. Arjuna saw Indra's attempt to put out the fire, and he sent hundreds of thousands of arrows in a tight network over the forest. The net of arrows acted as a vast umbrella and completely checked the falling rain. The Naga, Takshaka, was not present in the Kandava, but both his wife and son were caught in the blaze. They flew swiftly upwards and were seen by Arjuna. He instantly fired an arrow which severed the snake lady's head. He then trained another arrow upon Takshaka's son, Ashvasena. Seeing this, Indra raised a violent wind around Arjuna, which temporarily deprived him of his senses. Ashvasena escaped and disappeared into the sky. As he regained his senses, Arjuna became angry with Indra. He shouted a challenge to the god and covered the sky with his arrows. Indra too became angry with Arjuna and released his tremendous thunderbolt weapon. Without delay, Arjuna invoked his Vayavya, the wind weapon, which dispersed the huge black clouds. That powerful wind weapon completely dispelled the energy of Indra's thunderbolts and lightning flashes. The sky became clear and a gentle breeze began to blow. Agni blazed up even more, fanned by the breeze, and fed with the fat of bodies burning in the forest, he filled the sky with his roars. Indra summoned many other celestials to fight with Arjuna. Hosts of powerful heavenly fighters appeared and began to send their weapons at both him and Krishna. Blazing iron balls, rocks, and countless arrows shot toward them. Arjuna countered all the missiles with his arrows. At the same time, he cut down his assailants, who fell screaming into the fire. Arjuna was unconquerable as he stood on the battlefield, releasing his deadly arrows, with Krishna skillfully guiding his chariot. It goes on. There's various devas come, and the Vishvadevas, Sajas, Rudras, etc. They all came charging at Krishna Arjuna. Even though they exerted themselves with full force, however, the celestials were unable to overpower Krishna and Arjuna. Struck by Arjuna's mystical arrows, the gods were forced to retreat. Indra smiled. He was pleased with Arjuna, who was, after all, his son. And he also understood Krishna's position. Indra knew that no one could overcome Krishna or anyone supported by him. Obviously, Krishna desired that Agni consume the forest, and at the same time, he was enhancing the fame and glory of his friend Arjuna. Then, desiring to test Arjuna's power further, Indra sent down a thick shower of boulders. Arjuna quickly reduced the stones to dust with his swift arrows. Arjuna, Indra, then tore off the peak of a massive mountain and hurled it at Arjuna. Not disturbed in the least, Arjuna cut the flying mountain peak into 1,000 pieces, which rained down upon the forest below. Indra was gladdened by Arjuna's prowess. He ordered the celestials to withdraw, and as he did so, an invisible voice was heard in the sky. It was Brahma. Oh, Indra, your friend Takshaka is not in the forest at present, nor will it be possible for you to defeat in battle Arjuna and Krishna. These two are Nara and Narayana, the immortal and invincible rishis. They're worthy even of the gods' worship. Desist from the battle, for the burning of the Kandava forest has been ordained by fate. Having heard that voice, which they knew belonged to the universal creator Brahma, the gods retired to their abodes. For 15 days, Agni continued to consume the forest along with its inhabitants. As the forest was destroyed, hordes of Rakshasas, Danavas, and Nagas rushed out in fear. Arjuna cut them down with volleys of arrows. None could even look at him as he stood releasing his searing shafts. 15 days worth. That's longer than Krishna held Govardhan Hill. Gradually the forest was reduced to ashes and Agni was gratified. And in concluding, well, Maya Danava comes and there's a whole description of what happens. As the flames in the forest died down, Indra again appeared before Arjuna and Krishna. Agni stood next to him and said, O Partha, O Keshava, you have achieved that which could not be achieved by any celestial. Please ask for me any boon you desire. I am very much pleased. What did Arjuna ask for? All his weapons. Indra smiled and replied that he would indeed give him all the weapons, but not just yet. When Shiva would offer Arjuna his Pashupat weapon, then Indra would bring him to heaven and give him all the fire and wind weapons. That time would come in the future. And Krishna's benediction? Krishna asked that his friendship with Arjuna might last forever, and Indra said, it shall be so. Finally, Agni said, I also wish to give you a boon. Just as I pervade this universe, so by my power, you will be able to go anywhere you desire within the universe. The gods then returned to their heavens. Maya Danava again. So Maya wanted to do some service. Arjuna refused. He insisted. Arjuna refused. Krishna said, if you really want to do something, you can make a special place at Indraprastha for them. And he did it. He gathered materials from the place where he had deposited them. That's a long explanation. So, yeah. Maya explained that he had formerly had been engaged by Vrisha Parva, king of the Danavas, to construct special sacrificial altars for the Asuras. He had gathered all kinds of celestial materials, which he had stored at Vrisha Parva's house high up in the Mainaka mountain. There was also a great club, which Vrishaparva had once withstood the gods in battle. Maya would bring that club, equal to 100,000 ordinary clubs, and give it to Bhima. Who else do you give a club to? Yeah, so it's a gift from Maya Danava. He would also fetch from the depths of a lake in Mainaka the large celestial conch known as Devadatta for Arjuna, which he used at the, yeah. If Arjuna blew that conch on the battlefield, it would shatter his opponent's hearts. So, Mayadana went off to gather the things, and this palace construction was made at Indraprastha. So that's where we ended yesterday. That was a warm-up. Now it's tonight. So now we're back in Braja, where Nanda and the cowherd men are seeing these fallen trees, and they heard the little boys, and they're deciding whatever they're going to do. Nanda and the cowherd men did not believe the children because their feelings for Krishna would not allow them to think that Krishna was omnipotent. Some of the men, however, remembered Gargamuni's prediction about Krishna's being equal to Narayana. Though full of affection for Krishna, some became uncertain and thought, maybe he did it. And that final Jiva Goswami's commentary, short. The cowherd men headed by Nanda could not believe the children's words as children, a child could not uproot two trees. Others were doubtful of the children's words. Having the highest affection as elders, they did not accept the words of the children. So now we're reading 10, 11, 16. Chapter 11, text 16. When Nanda Maharaj saw his son bound with ropes to the wooden mortar and dragging it, he smiled and released Krishna from his bonds. And the purport, Prabhupada's purport here, Nanda Maharaj was surprised that Yashoda, Krishna's mother, could have bound her beloved child in such a way. Krishna was exchanging love with her. How then could she have been so cruel as to bind him to the wooden mortar? Nanda Maharaj understood this exchange of love, and therefore he smiled and released Krishna. In other words, as Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, binds the living entity to fruitive activities, he binds Mother Yashoda and Nanda Maharaj in parental affection. This is his pastime. Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur writes, glancing constantly over all of Krishna's limbs, Nanda smiled. Your mother, whose lap you prefer to mine, has bound you because of your small offense? So how can I release you? Thinking in this way, he was smiling. In the same way that you bind the jivas with maya, you bind your mother and father with prema. And Jiva Goswami writes, this verse shows Nanda's strong vatsalya, parental affection. The description of Krishna with the mortar is repeated in this verse from the previous verse to indicate that Nanda saw the sweetness of the pastime. It awakened his prema when he considered that his child was young but healthy in spite of pulling the mortar. He examined his son in all his limbs. He smiled in order to make the frightening, bound-up child happy. He had a smile on his face because internally he was angry at Yashoda on seeing his son tied up and feared the fall of the two trees. He also saw the smiling face of his son. Vishnu Purana says, quote, he saw the child who smiled, showing his tiny new white teeth, unquote. Krishna was afraid of his father, But on seeing Nanda smile, the child also smiled in order to have his father understand that he was not fearful and thus satisfying him. His father freed him from the rope tied to the mortar. He first of all untied the rope binding him to the mortar. The word ha expresses joy. Just as Yashoda was able to tie up Krishna, Nanda was able to untie him. Thus, Nanda had similar prema. Nanda did not notice the huge quantity of rope used for tying Krishna. And Jiva Goswami writes, when Nanda Maharaj saw his own son bound with ropes to the wooden mortar and dragging it, he smiled and released Krishna from his bonds. This verse describes the great affection of Nanda for Krishna. He saw Krishna with all his limbs. He smiled in order to extinguish the fear of the frightened child, though internally he was disturbed. And now there's some commentary from Preeti Sandarbha. It's a book by, it's part of six Sandarbhas written by Jiva Goswami, like a commentary on the Bhagavatam, and it's describing the stage of affection or love for Krishna. A sweet smile may be used to encourage Krishna when he is in grief, gives this example, Nanda's smile. Even when he is in distress, a devotee in Vatsalya Rasa may pretend to smile in order to reassure Lord Krishna. Maybe as parents you do like that sometimes, your children are distressed and you want to have them not be so stressed out, so you smile and pat them and things. So that's what Nanda was. He was inside worried and fearful and stuff, but he wanted to calm his son. Final is 10.11.7. The gopis... No, so that ends the pastime with the trees falling. Now moving, it says childhood pastimes. That's the chapter. So here's the gopis, the elder gopis, the ladies. The gopis would say, if you dance, my dear Krishna, then I shall give you half a sweetmeat. By saying these words or by clapping their hands, all the gopis encouraged Krishna in different ways. At such times, although he was the supremely powerful personality of Godhead, he would smile and dance according to their desire, as if he were a wooden doll in their hands. Sometimes he would sing very loudly at their bidding. In this way, Krishna came completely under the control of the gopis, Yasoda's friends. The earlier chapter 8 was his stealing, Makanchur Leela. Now he's a little older, and he's doing these other things with them. That's it. Huh? Between 2 and 3. Vishwanath Chakravarti writes, who can describe the good fortune of Nanda and Yashoda, Krishna's father and mother? Although he is the controller of Brahma and Shiva and others, Krishna is controlled at every step by the inhabitants of Braja. This is described in 3.5 verses. Quote, if you dance, I will give you a sweet. Inspired by the gopis, stobitaha, the Lord, something that means joking, laughing, stobha. The Lord sometimes danced, just like a normal boy, balavat. Sometimes, without showing his powers because of the gopis' love, he would sing like a wooden puppet. Jiva Goswami writes, not only was he controlled by the prema of his mother and father, having the highest affection for him, Other gopis also controlled him. Previous events are described in two verses. These gopis were generally elderly. Though Bhagavan was full of all powers, he was like other boys. He forgot his own powers by being absorbed in his childhood pastimes, controlled by the rasa of its prema. He acted according to his childhood pastimes. Sometimes he sang, sometimes he danced, and sometimes he appeared ignorant. As a small child, he knew dancing a little, sometimes showing himself to be ignorant, mugdha, or in dancing he was charming. He danced because he was controlled by them like a puppet on strings. And now last is Jiva Goswami explains, again this is Preeti Sandarbha. Sometimes contrary elements such as enemies acting unfavorably became udipana, stimulations of ecstatic love, just as the heat of the sun stimulate desire for water. Nice comparison. This is, Jiva Goswami was a student and nephew of Rupa Goswami. Rupa Goswami received detailed instructions from Lord Chaitanya about the science of rasa, and he wrote books on bhakti, bhakti rasa, bhakti rasamrita sindhu. And so this term udipana is from that book. Udipana means that which stimulates ecstatic love, like, you know, how Krishna would smile, or Krishna's playing his flute, or Krishna's glancing with his eyes, or even his clothes and the description of his garlands, and these are all stimulations of ecstatic love, udipanas. Udipanas. So sometimes when some obstacle would come, an enemy would come, it would also serve as a stimulation of ecstatic love. The comparison is how rain stimulates one becoming thirsty. And it gives an example, it gives several examples. This first example comes at the marriage of Rukmini, where Balaram heard that Rukmini sent a messenger to Krishna. Krishna agreed to marry her, and by kidnapping her. So Balaram knew there's going to be a battle. So Balaram becomes inspired to help Krishna, come to Krishna's aid. When Balaram heard about these preparations of the inimical kings and how Krishna had set off alone to steal the bride, he feared that a fight would ensue. Immersed in affection for his brother, he hurried to Kundina. Kundina is King Bhishmaka's capital city in Vidarbha. So she's Vidarbhi. His kingdom is Vidarbha and the capital is Kundina. King Bhishmaka, that's where Rukmini lived. So he set off, hurried to Kundina, with a mighty army consisting of infantry and soldiers riding on elephants, horses, and chariots. He's coming from Dwarka to do this. Commentary continues. Dirt in which children play stimulates vatsalya, parental affection. When elders act unfavorably to lovers in kanta bhav, that's ecstasies of conjugal love, the unfavorable elements generate the seven minor rasas, like fear, and nourish the main priti rasa. So what this is saying is, this is Rupa Goswami's, when you read Nectar Devotion, you'll learn all this. There's five primary rasas, and there's seven secondary rasas. 5 plus 7 equals 12. The the five primary rasas. We did this with a teenager. We said it twice and she said it back the third time. Neutrality. Servitorship. Friendship, like Arjuna. Parental affection, like Nanda and Yasoda. And conjugal love, like the gopis and the queens of Dwarka. So, neutrality, servitorship, friendship, parental affection, and conjugal. Those are the five primary. So, when there's the conjugal rasa, and there's some opposition, then it invokes one of the other seven secondary rasas. They become stimulated and enhances the primary rasa. Like, you know, this example of Mother Yasoda seeing the universe inside Krishna's mouth. It invoked astonishment. That's a secondary rasa. So Krishna knows how to stimulate the love of Mother Yasoda by, from time to time, something astonishing. Or lifting a Govardhan hill, or, you know, he does something astonishing. It discloses his divinity, but it serves to promote or stimulate a secondary rasa. This is explained in Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu. The five primary rasas, beginning with neutrality, are accepted as Hari Bhakti rasa. The secondary rasas generally act as vyabhichari bhavas within the primary rasa. So again, it's stimulations of ecstatic love. Thus, the udipanas, sorry for the technical language, but that's what the comment, so the udipanas, the stimulations of ecstatic love have been indicated. Among them, those related to Sri Vrindavan Dham are outstanding. Ah, there resides the objects most treasured by Krishna, who is the object of the highest priti or affection, love. And he gives scriptural references. Shukadev Goswami in this chapter 11, later verse. Oh, King Parikshit, when Rama and Krishna saw Vrindavan, Govardhan, and the banks of the river Yamuna, they both enjoyed great pleasure. Or, in a later chapter, Krishna himself praises Vrindavan. Oh, greatest of lords, speaking to Balaram, just see how these trees are bowing their heads at your lotus feet, which are worshipable by the devatas, by offering you their fruits and flowers, having taken birth as trees to eradicate the darkness of ignorance of others by their actions. Great devotees praise it. This is now Brahma. In Brahma's prayers, after stealing the calves and cowherd boys, he comes before Krishna and he sees what he sees. He offers prayers. This is from those prayers. My greatest possible good fortune would be to take any birth, whatever, in this forest of Gokula and have my head bathed by the dust falling from the lotus feet of any of its residents. Their entire life and soul is the Lord Mukunda, the dust of whose lotus feet is sought even today by the Upanishads. And then later is Uddhava, after he took the message from Krishna to the gopis, and he's appreciating Vrindavan in this way. The gopis of Vrindavan have given up the association of their husbands, sons, and other family members who are very difficult to give up, and they have forsaken their relatives in the path of Dharma to obtain the lotus feet of Mukunda Krishna, which even the Vedas pursue. Oh, let me be fortunate enough to become one of the bushes, creepers, or herbs in Vrindavan, because the gopis bless them with the dust of their lotus feet. And then in another verse from Canto 10, chapter 21, O friend, Vrindavan is spreading the glory of the earth, having obtained the treasure of the lotus feet of Krishna, the son of Devaki, with peacocks dancing madly when they hear Govinda's flute, with all other creatures remaining stunned at the top of the hills as they watch the dancing. The pastime that Krishna performed there, the pastimes that Krishna performed there are the highest. In the relation to the 18-syllable mantra, gives the mantra, the thousands of avatars of Krishna are all auspicious. Among them, the young boy is the rarest. Balatvam means a person up to 16 years. Until 8, the child is an infant, as if in the womb. He is called a child Bala or Poganda up to 16 years. Then, going back to something that we mentioned, chapter 8, great devotees sing of the activities of Krishna in his childhood, with which Vasudeva and Devaki could not experience, which even today destroy the sins of all people. So it goes on. It's just expressing the glories of Vrindavan Dham and how the Vrindavan Dham stimulates love for Krishna like no other place. Other places may also, but the Braja Leela of Krishna are most exalted and expressed. So he's giving references and references and references. Here's one of those references, chapter 8. When Krishna and Balaram, with the strength of their legs, crawled about zigzag in the muddy places of Braja, the sound of their ankle bells was very charming. Pleased by the sound of other people's ankle bells, they used to follow these people. But when they saw that they were other people, not their parents, they became afraid and returned to their real mothers. Or, in that same chapter 29, chapter 8, your son comes to our houses before the milking of the cows and releases the calves. And when the masters of the house becomes angry, your son merely smiles. Sometimes he devises some process by which he steals palatable curd butter and milk, which he then eats and drinks. When the monkeys assemble, he divides it with them, and when the monkeys have had their bellies so full they won't take any more, he breaks the pots. Sometimes when he gets no opportunity to steal butter or milk from a house, he will be angry at the householders and he make the small children cry and then run away. He even says it pinches them. Two more. Praised by the elder gopis, the Lord, like a puppet on strings, sometimes danced like other boys. Sometimes he sang and sometimes acted ignorantly. Sometimes Krishna and Balaram would play on their flutes. Sometimes they would throw bilva fruits using slings. Sometimes they danced, making their ankle bells tinkle. These are all in the category of stimulations of ecstatic love. The Krishna is performing the pastimes or hearing about them, remembering them, seeing paintings that illustrate them and so forth. You know, the remembrance of Krishna in his Vrindavan pastimes serves to, it's cleansed, on one side it's cleansing, and the other side it's stimulating of ecstatic love. So the pastimes that we're reading from are glorified in that way. Yeah.
In the war, when he put the Gita for him, and he some
I know someone is going for English word.
The purpose of the microphone is
to... When he surrendered himself to Lord Krishna, that's when he realized he is the ultimate God.
Well, Krishna, Arjuna's relationship with Krishna is Sakya Rasa. And he's also Krishna's bhakta. Krishna says that in Bhagavad Gita. Bhaktosi me sakha cheti. He says to Arjuna, because you're my bhakta and you're my sakha, you'll understand everything. So there's these two things going on simultaneously with Arjuna. That is, he understands who Krishna is and he's Krishna's sakha. He's his friend. I'm responding. It's not that he didn't know that Krishna is God. But he's in this very special zone. There are persons that don't know anything about anything. And then there's the Vrijbasis who know everything, but their love is so strong they can't even see it. And then there's this middle zone, like, you know, Hastinapur and Mathura. And even in Dwarka, they have an understanding of Krishna's divinity, but they have other relationships with Krishna that sometimes eclipse. Here's a nice example, classic. Krishna kills Kamsa and Chanu and Mushtika and, you know, the wrestlers and so forth. Then he goes to the prison house to free his mother and father. They heard that he killed Kamsa. So they're seeing him like they saw him when he was first born, the four-armed Vasudev Krishna. But Krishna, he wanted to be reunited. He's 12 years old. He hasn't been with mom and dad since, you know, he was that night he was born. He wants parental affection. But they're seeing him as God. So he then covered them with his yogamaya potency. So they just forgot that he's God and treated him and Balaram like their sons. So there's this dual position in this, I'm calling it the middle zone. And Arjuna was in that zone. Sometimes it was prominent that he understood Krishna as God. He was his devotee. And sometimes more prominent was just he is my friend.
So there is actually six rasas, if I might say, between Sakya Ras and the Bhakti Ras.
No. His primary rasa with Krishna is friendship. That's his primary rasa. And in that category of, so Krishna had friends in Braja. And Krishna had friends with Arjuna. Krishna had friendship with Uddhava. He was also his dear friend. He had friendship, relationships, primary relationships. And some of those, there's less understanding of his divinity, and some of them there's more understanding of his divinity. And it's even more understanding of his divinity in Dwarka than in Mathura and Hastinapur. But there's still the primary rasa.
How about Pitama Bhishma and Krishna then?
How about Bhishma?
Yeah, because I mean, he was actually intimidating Krishna to fight with him.
Well, that's another story. The primary rasa of grandfather Bhishma is dasya, the servitorship rasa. And there's a secondary rasa that was prominent with Bhishma, and that was chivalry. Krishna likes feisty dealings. It's not primary, but it's in his character. That's a secondary rasa. Grandfather Bhishma knew that. So he acted in a way that appeared in his primary rasa as a servant. He was stimulating Krishna's chivalry.
Pushing him, I guess.
As a service to Krishna.
A Okay, one last question.
But you follow?
Yes, it makes sense, but...
But?
Well,
I know some people that they're like, they're the best of friends. And sometimes the way they talk to each other, it's in friendship, it's in jest. But they say, you know, some stirring thing, the other person says some stirring things, and it's all in jest. It's in friendship. But it's like chivalrous, you know, talk. It's like, whoa, I would never do that. Their friendship is so intimate. They would speak like this with one another. Two sannyasis, they're dear friends. And they would say this and say that and like, whoa. Then I started to understand. They don't take it in a personal way. It's just part of like going like this and going like that. You know. And they like
there is no winning or losing. It's just...
It's fun. It's having fun.
Okay.
And so Grandfather Bhishma knew. He knew that Krishna would protect Arjuna. No way would he not protect Arjuna. So he took a vow. Krishna broke my vow? I who've never broken a vow? Krishna broke my vow? He took those 5 arrows? I take a vow.
I'm going to make him fight.
Krishna's going to break his vow. Or I'll kill Arjuna.
Okay, and one last question.
And so that's chivalry. And he's firing arrows at Krishna. And Krishna's... Krishna liked it.
Because he wants to make his bhaktas happy at the end.
Yeah. And the bhaktas want to make him happy. And that's their relationship. The servitor and the served. And Krishna likes. Now it's a whole other thing. Prabhupada gives the example of a king would sometimes keep in his entourage a wrestler. Because kings like bashing and getting bashed. They like it. No, I don't like it. Probably you don't like it. But kings like it. They don't want a wimpy guy that's the wrestler. They want a guy that's going to really like whack them. And they whack them back. They like it. And it's like family. He's, you know, he's his wrestler. And wherever he goes, he's got his it's not social security, I mean, it's not a security officer guard. It's, you know, somebody he can tussle with. He likes it. So as kings, where do they get? That's in Krishna. He likes a tussle.
And one more question is, which age Krishna came, how would I ask that? Let me ask you this, like, what age of Krishna you find it more impressive or lovable?
What's the adjective? Most interesting, attractive?
When he was a baby, when he was in teenage years, when he was in his prime time.
Oh, in his Braja Leela, we heard pages and pages and pages and pages of description of Krishna's ages. Like when he went to see Vasudeva Devaki in the prison. Our acharyas go over details and details and details of which the chronology and his age and his child development and like when he was crawling. When he was crawling, how old was he? By normal child development, a child's crawling is at such and such age, and Krishna did it way earlier. And then when he started walking, it was way earlier. He was like, you know, he grew up quickly. And Balaram also. But so your question specifically is his age and his age. When he left Vrindavan, he was 12 years, 8 months. And his pastimes in Vrindavan are most attractive. So that's like, you know, from his early childhood pastimes until 12. But yeah, I find particularly attractive, like, you know, Krishna's lifting of Govardhan Hill. It was when he was 7 years old. you know, think of one of these boys when they're 7 years old and lifting up, you know, a chair. What to speak of a mountain. So he's exhibiting, but he was doing this for the purpose of his satisfying his devotees. Because his pastimes were for the pleasure of his devotees. But so during the course of the day, he would sometimes be with the cowherd boys and the cows, and sometimes he would not be with them, and then he was with his mother and father, and sometimes he was with the gopis, and, you know, they were all, when they were with him, that was great, and then when they weren't, they were like feeling separation. So he made an arrangement. He could be with them all for 7 days, nonstop. It was a big festival, real festival for Vraja. And there were many things being accomplished. So his pastimes in Vraja is not specifically an age, but his pastimes in Vraja are most attractive for me. And I would say, you know, when he's interacting with the cowherd boys and the cowherd girls, it's especially meaningful, more so than, you know, the Mukunchor Lila early pastimes. The chapter 8 pastimes don't hold the same charm, maybe because I'm a sannyasi or something. They were young. As he was young, they grew. This is something that our acharyas say. When he was united with Vasudeva and Devaki, he was 12 plus some months. But then much later in Dwarka, where he is however old he was, Pradumna, his first queen was Rukmini, and their first son was Pradumna. There's a verse later in the Bhagavatam, when Pradumna entered the inner chamber of Krishna's palace, he was just 12 years old, and the ladies mistook him for Krishna. So they became very shy. When then they realized it was Pradumna, the shyness went away. Which meant, inductively, Krishna looked the same age as Pradumna. I mean, you don't look the same age as your son. But Krishna didn't age beyond that. Although he was, you know, sometimes it said he's 16, but there specifically in the verse says 12. You know, the young, youthful, yovana.
I have a question, Maharaj. Thank you so much for the beautiful lecture. One of my question is, which rasa is better over the other? Or I know they're supposed to be the same, but I know Madhurya Ras covers all the below.
Yes, it does.
So
yes.
Is there anything that's better?
It's not better. It's perfect or perfect or perfect or perfect or perfect. At the same time that's perfect, we discussed this the other day. Why is it that the followers of Lord Chaitanya particularly, or Srimad Bhagavatam particularly, appreciates the love of the gopis especially? And there's many, many features, but it's detailed. But commonly, just the degree of selflessness of their love is unequaled. And it's not to say that Mother Jasoda was selfish, but the degree of selflessness of the gopis is unexcelled. And the intensity of that love of selflessness attracts Krishna. So he likes. And they like. So whatever, another way of saying the same thing, it's a different way of saying the same thing, is whatever is in the previous rasa is in also within the second rasa plus. Whatever is in that rasa, the subsequent rasa includes that plus. So that the love of the gopis is the maximum plus. And it's the selflessness. And it's not to say the coward boys were selfish, or Arjuna was selfish, or Mother Yashoda was selfish, or Vasudeva and Devaki was selfish. It's not to say like that, but the intensity of selflessness is unequaled. Yeah?
So, thank you. How do we know which ras we are in, when does that...
You have to become purified to know. Sure. Then you'll know. And before then, you won't know. It's like, let's say you have a jar that has seeds. You don't know, is it going to be marigold seeds. Is it going to be an orange one or a yellow one? You don't know. But when it sprouts, then you'll know. And sometimes they're the smaller flowers, sometimes they're the bigger flowers, sometimes they're really big flowers. You don't know until it sprouts. So you'll find out your rasa when you become purified. And your little boy is going to be playful for quite a long time.
And how do we know when we're purified completely?
Because how do we know what?
When we're purified completely, or even because...
Well, how do you know when you've eaten a meal that you've had enough? You don't have to have someone tell you. You say, oh, thank you. That there's a verse in the Bhagavatam that speaks like that. Bhakti parishano bhavo viraktir anyatracha. There are symptoms that is compared to the eating process. The second part of the verse says, just like when you fasted, you know what happens. You become weak, you become hungry. And then when you break the fast, your fatigue goes, your hunger goes, and you become satisfied. And it's predictable. So this is predictable, but you won't know until bhakti becomes sufficiently awakened. And then viraktir anyatra cha. Other things, they lose interest. And the interest is in topics of Krishna, the ear goes. It's just not like, okay, now it's time to... It's like the Ganges flowing downstream during monsoon season. You have to tell the Ganges, okay, you can flow downstream now. The Ganges is flowing.
So does it fluctuate when we get to that level?
No, there's variety, but it doesn't fluctuate. There's diversity, unlimited diversity, but it doesn't fluctuate. It's just varieties of intensity of feelings towards Krishna and eagerness that may sometimes even look like, you know, when Krishna is absent, feeling sad. It looks, you know, that doesn't look like a pleasant feeling at all, but it's an intense feeling of love. So there's variety, all variety. In the it's described like this, that bhava is where there's a rise of emotion like a wave. That's the bhava bhakti stage. And the prema bhakti stage is where there's constant waves and they're constantly mixing, and one cannot distinguish one from the other. But there are symptoms of this bhava and that bhava, and that's what nectar devotion is describing. The waves, that's why it's an ocean. Sindhu. Bhakti, rasa, amrita, sindhu. So it's just waves and waves mixing. So does it stop? It doesn't stop. It's just varieties.
Thank you, Maharaj.
Okay.
Online questions. This is from Govardhan, Varshana Mataji's son.
Mm.
How do we understand when Krishna lies to Mother Yashoda? He says he didn't eat dirt, he didn't eat butter, but when he has eaten dirt.
Well, we don't know whether he ate dirt or not. It doesn't say definitively that he did or did not. The cowherd boyfriend said he did, and he said he didn't. We don't know definitively whether they were lying or he was lying. But how do we understand even if they were lying or he was lying? It's a pastime. And there was a purpose of the pastime. And the purpose of the pastime is Krishna wanted several things, but he wanted the affection of his loving mother Yashoda to scold him. Now, have you ever thought about wanting your mother to scold you? No. But if she does, maybe she never does, but if she ever does, it's because of love. It's because of love. And Krishna knew that. So he wanted her to scold him. He wanted that particular variety of affection, just like Krishna wanted Bhishma to shoot arrows at him. He wanted. So Bhishma did. And Krishna's going, ah. So Krishna wanted. So whether he ate dirt or didn't eat dirt, the pastime was arranged for that display of Mother Yashoda's affection for him. Then he had other things he wanted to do. He wanted to inspire the secondary rasa of astonishment. So he showed the universe. He showed everything is within him, his divinity. God is he from whom everything rests, or within whom everything rests. So that's the answer to Govardhan's question. It's a rasa. It's a pastime to inspire Mother Yashoda's love in a particular way. You know, if you tell a lie to your mother, that's no good. When Krishna tells a lie to his mother, that's good. Because it's for the purpose of stimulating her love only. And that's not why you might lie.
That's the second question, out of topic. How is thinking connected to brain?
How is what?
Thinking. Thinking.
What?
Thinking connected to brain.
Thinking connected to the brain.
Brain is a physical thing, and thinking and mind are not physical. But we need the head to think.
Well, it's definitely off topic. And the brain is not the mind. The brain is not the mind. Memory is not stored in the brain. Memory is stored in the mind. Mind is subtle. It's not that the mind is not physical. The mind is physical. But it's subtle physical, not gross physical. The brain is gross physical. The mind is subtle physical. And you know there's just like, here's a computer, and there's hardware and there's software. And they both have to be in order for the computer to work. The mind is the software, and the brain is the hardware.
And this next question is from Gopi Priya, Shyamasundar Prabhu's daughter. Are there seasons like summer, spring, etc. in Goloka? And is there time in Goloka?
There's time. That's a nice question. It's a fascinating topic. And to keep it a fascinating topic simple, time as we know it is absent. But there's an appearance, a yoga, maya appearance of the passage of time. Time as we know it is a measure of the movement of the sun. It's called Kalachakra in Sanskrit. And according to, you read carefully in the third canto of Bhagavatam, the smallest unit of time is the time it takes for the sun to cross one atom. And then when there's a certain number of atoms, that's another unit of time, and certain other atoms, another unit of time, and then you get minutes and so forth. So time in this world destroys things. Time in the spiritual world doesn't destroy things because it's time eternal. So there's no matter to be destroyed in the spiritual world, but there's spiritual energy, and it's not just energy that's destroyed with time. But there's the seeming sense, the Yogamaya sense, of the passage of time, thus day and night. So, you know, the description of the universal form, or the description in the fifth canto, is the sun in a period of 24 hours moves on this Kala Chakra, the wheel of time. The sun moves in a clockwise direction. The sun rises in the east and it sets in the west and it's gone. Then it comes back again in the east, and in 24 hours the sun moves. And that's the passage of time. And time brings the change of seasons and brings all kinds of things. But in the spiritual world, there's no sun that moves. There's no passage of time. There's no Kala Chakra. Time is eternal. While saying that, for the sake of pastimes, there's different times of the day, the rising of the sun, and then it's time for the cowherd boys to go and take care of herding the cows. And then as the sun comes to the afternoon time, they come back, and then it's a big festival in Braja for the people who've been separated from Krishna for the day, to get his association again and bathe him and feed him and so forth and so on, put him to bed, tell him stories, and, you know, two things that the parental affection is all about. And then he's with the gopis. So he's 24/7, he's engaged. And with different pastimes, with different groups of devotees. But there's no passage of time as we know it. It doesn't just, nothing is destroyed. It's eternal time. Like we read in Bhagavad Gita, for example. We read in Bhagavad Gita chapter 8. In the spiritual world, there's no need of sunlight, moonlight, or electricity. And yet there's a sun. And there's a moon. We don't know about electricity. Sun and moon. But in Krishna Loka, it's always a full moon. For Krishna's pastimes purposes, it's always a full moon. And there's a sun, but it's not the kind of movement of the sun that destroys things. Time here destroys things. In the spiritual world, time doesn't destroy things. So that's a little explanation. It's a fascinating topic. Next question.
Why is it so difficult?
Here's the microphone. Why is it so difficult
to identify as the soul, and so easy to identify with body or mind?
Well, because we're conditioned, and the deluding potency called Mahamaya is very strong, and we're under her grip. We've been under her grip for a long time. When you're in prison, why is it so difficult to get out of prison? Because the prison warden has strict policies. So Durga is in charge of the prison of material creation. And she's got some really strong people and binding forces.
The next question is from Sunita Mataji. When Krishna's pastimes happen in other planets or universes, does it happen in similar place names like Mathura, Vrindavan and Dwarka?
Yes. Yes. I mean, that's my understanding, I'll say. Because his place of pastimes, that's his place of pastimes.
This is Sridevi Mataji. Before entering into the 10th canto of Srimad Bhagavatam, which explains the sweetness of Krishna, we have to study the first 9 cantos, which shows his greatness.
Mm.
Which aspect that we have to meditate, whether Krishna is very simple and easy to approach, or he is so great that we have to look at him as my master? Which aspect do we have to meditate on?
Do you understand the question? Not the whole preamble, but just the question part.
So, do we have to meditate on his sweetness or greatness?
His sweetness or greatness. Why? Why make a distinction? I mean, the sweetness is resting upon his greatness, which is part of his greatness. But we won't have the proper understanding of his sweetness if we don't have a proper understanding of his greatness. We'll take it as mundane, like Ma and Pa and the kids. It's not the same. It's there's some resemblance, but it's not the same. Unless we have the Aishwarya aspect clear, the sweetness will be misunderstood.
This is from Govinda Mohini Mataji. We learn that Balaram is the first expansion of Krishna and not different than Krishna. Only difference is their color. But we don't see Lord Balaram being worshipped outside of ISKCON. Can you please explain why?
I don't know if it's true we don't find Balaram being worshipped outside of ISKCON. He's not as prominently, by far, he's not prominently worshipped as Krishna is worshipped. But Balaram is worshipped elsewhere. I mean, when we visit Vrindavan, it looks like because of the pandemic situation, we won't be going to Vrindavan this year, but next year we will. And one of the places we'll go is the Dauji temple. And all over Vrindavan, Balaram is there's places where there's Dauji temples, but there's humongous Dauji deity in the southern part of Braja and in other places. It's particularly, he's appreciated in Braja because his pastimes are in Braja, but he's known as Dauji, the elder brother. Okay. Anything else, anybody? Okay, Prabhupada ki jai.